Dan's going to play us back into part two. Thanks, Dan. So here we are back to do the next part, which is the suspects, the theories, the fun, exciting part where we all get to basically have a big old chat about it and about what we think. Jeffrey's going to tell us what he thinks first, obviously, because that's how this works.
On the contrary, absolutely not.
Cass has helpfully taken Betsy and looking after her for us.
I think the important thing to remember is that the Metropolitan Police Service did an extraordinary job. They interviewed literally thousands of people. They identified 300 suspects and they detained 80 people but never had any evidence to convict anyone of the Whitechapel murders. The Whitechapel murders remain one of the great unsolved mysteries of English criminal law. The most famous of the original suspects was a Dorset-born barrister called Montague John Druitt, who died in almost immediately after the last murder, the Mary Kelly murder. He was an assistant schoolmaster in Blackheath who was dismissed shortly after Mary Kelly's killing. Now, it's been suggested that he was dismissed because he was gay and that he'd been propositioning the pupils. It's also been suggested that he had, which he did, to be fair, a history of mental illness in the family, both his mother and father. In 1895, in Sir Melville McNaughton's report, quotes, on the killings, he suggested that Druitt was responsible. Abilene, Detective Inspector, dismissed it out of hand. Druitt was found floating in the River Thames on the 31st of December, 1888, his decomposed body. He'd obviously killed himself.
No, I mean, not obviously. So we'd have just established how many people were being murdered at that time.
Well, I think it's pretty... thank you. It's pretty clear, however, that he had... sorry, I'm jumping to conclusions there. I should never do that.
True.
I don't think Druitt is in any way credible.
Why was he even selected as being a possible suspect?
Because of McNaughton.
Okay.
In fact, it was suggested that he was playing cricket in Dorset in the day after the first murder, so he couldn't possibly have got from London to Dorset.
The classic cricket.
To play cricket. That particular... I mean, you know. The second one... I mean, forgive me, I am compressing these. The second one is Aaron Kosminski, a Polish Jew, born in September 1865, who was admitted to Coney Hatch Mental Asylum. Well, I have to confess here that I was brought up almost directly opposite Coney Hatch Mental Asylum.
Where's Coney Hatch Mental Asylum?
North London.
Is it still
between
still
Finchley
there?
And Southgate. In fact, the man who lived next door to us was a warder.
At the asylum.
At the asylum. And he always used to talk about the man who thought he was a piece of toast. Or the man who believed he was Napoleon.
Those were the
Kosminski, and I'm not entirely... forgive me, I don't mean to... forgive me,
you
this
digress.
Is serious. McNaughton believed that Kosminski was the Ripper. One of the other chief inspectors from the Metropolitan Police Service also thought he was, because he lived in Whitechapel and he suffered from delusions. Well, there's some very tenuous, very old-fashioned DNA evidence linking him to Catherine Eddowes. Remember the double event? Linking him to Catherine Eddowes' shawl. But most scientists now discount it. It's not convincing. Now we come to a more interesting possible. At one point, the Whitechapel murderer was known as the Leather Apron.
As previously discussed.
As previously.
All the butchers were interviewed.
Yeah, indeed. Who now, the Leather Apron, the most famous...
Butchers had leather aprons back then.
Sorry, darling. Sorry. The most famous Leather Apron was a man called John Pizer, who was a Polish Jew who worked... And that's important because it was important to that nature of the anti-Semitic feeling in Whitechapel.
The graffito.
He was a bootmaker in Whitechapel.
Oh, he didn't even have a leather apron.
He did have a leather apron. And many locals at the time suspected him as the Ripper. He did have a conviction for stabbing. And he had a particular police sergeant in uniform who didn't care for him. He was called Police Sergeant William Thick, with an E.
Like Robin. That's irrelevant. You won't get that. That's a modern reference.
I must catch up, you know. The point was that he had an alibi for at least two of the killings. And in the end, I think it was probably Police Sergeant...
Whoever it was.
Thick.
Who didn't like him.
Didn't like him. Later, not much, there was an extraordinary man called Francis Tumblety.
Tumblety?
Tumblety.
Like a Dickensian character.
Well, he was a Dickensian character. He was a con man. He posed as an Indian herb doctor in the United States. He was obviously a misogynist, a quack in every way. He was arrested in London on 7th of November 1888 for being, I'm afraid again, a gay, but was released. But one of the things that one of the many ripperologists like about Tumblety was that he collected female wombs.
Don't look at me like that. I just respond to this weird man's womb collecting.
He kept them in glass jars.
Victorian times were pretty odd, weren't they?
They were odd, yes. Yeah. It would be fair to say that he did flee England shortly after the Mary Kelly last of the five.
I'm keen on theories that the person isn't around after the last of the canonical five.
Okay.
Otherwise, why wouldn't they maybe have just kept committing murders?
Let's rush on then.
Okay.
At the time, a man called Thomas Cutbush, who was a medical student... I'm sorry. I know it's genital mutilation, but let's not get carried
Jeffrey.
Away.
A
medical... it's
terrible.
I have no shame. Was sent to Lambeth Infirmary in 1891, suffering from delusions, thought to have been brought on by syphilis. Now, syphilis is actually very important to this story because a lot of the possible suspects were suspected of having syphilis, having been driven mad. Cutbush, and I do love this, stabbed a woman in the bum and then tried to stab another woman in the bum He was found insane and sent to Broadmoor in 1891, where he remained until his death.
Poor old Cutbush.
1903. In 1894, the Sun, not the same Sun, but the Sun of those days, called in the Ripper. I don't think it's true.
You don't think it's him?
I don't think it's fair. But here's a more interesting one. A man called Karl Feigenbaum, a German merchant seaman, was arrested in New York in 1894 for cutting a woman's throat in front of her son. After his execution in April 1896, his lawyer said, Feigenbaum hated women and had a desire to kill and mutilate them.
His lawyer said that?
No proof whatever that he was in Whitechapel at the time.
He just had tendencies to...
Maybe.
Women hating and mutilating.
Well, it doesn't get any easier to solve this. Frederick Deeming killed his wife and four children in St. Helens in Lancashire in 1891. He got away with it. He went to Australia, married again, killed his second wife and buried her under the house.
Did he get away with that too? No, otherwise we wouldn't know about him.
He wrote a book.
Cool, personal expose.
And boasted that he was Jack the Ripper. There's no evidence whatever. But one Scotland Yard detective insisted that he was in England in that period between August and November 1888. Okay, now we come to the later speculative theories. Beginning with the most famous of all, the Duke of Clarence, Queen Victoria's grandson, son of Edward VII, always known as Eddie. He was first mentioned as a possible suspect in a biography of Edward VII in 1962. Then he was again mentioned by a man called Dr. Thomas Stowell in an article in The Criminologist in 1970. It is one of the great conspiracy theories. Let's put it once to say that Eddie was almost certainly not in the country at the time of the killings. But let's do the conspiracy theory. He had a child with a Roman Catholic shop assistant.
Her religion is relevant.
In the East End.
Oh.
And the Queen and the Prime Minister of the day, Lord Salisbury, and the Freemasons sought to murder anyone who knew anything about the child.
Okay. That's why people say it was a Freemason. No, because he
was a Freemason, but that's not the point.
But even those people wanted to kill anybody who knew about the child, but that doesn't mean that the Duke of Clarence would kill anyone who knew about his child.
No, it's almost certain the Duke of Clarence was nowhere even in the country, but there have been all sorts of variations of this extraordinary theory. Sir William Gull, which I'll come on to, Walter Sickert the painter, the poet James Stephen, all part of this conspiracy to make sure that Prince Albert Victor, the Duke of Clarence, should not have his name sullied by this
taken through the mask
liaison. Betsy's already got bored.
Betsy's resurfaced. She just disappeared into the crowd for like 15 minutes. I was a bit worried.
I have to say, and I make the point absolutely firmly, I think it's total tosh. The next one isn't. A man called David Cohen, known as David Cohen, was sent to Coney Hatch Mental Asylum shortly after Mary Keller's death. He was an East Ender and called locally violent, antisocial. He was identified by one of the Ripperologists, Martin Fido, whom you may well all have read, as a leather apron. He was actually called Nathan Kaminsky. It was a bootmaker who lived in Whitechapel, who was treated for syphilis.
Haven't we done him? I'm getting really confused. No. A different bootmaker?
Different bootmaker.
Oh.
One of the old FBI profilers, John Douglas, suggests that the person known to the police as, quotes, David Cohen, had the behavioural characteristics most close to the Ripper.
So has there been an... I do not claim to be a professional... Well, expert is the word I'm looking for, in this at all. Has there been a lot of that kind of backdated psychological analysis of...
There has been. And I'll come on to it. I mean, genuinely, there has been a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially by the guys from the Behavioural Science Unit, the retired
Post-Mindhunter.
The Mindhunters. The Mindhunters.
We're big fans of Mindhunters.
We are. Sir William Gull, whom you mentioned earlier, a physician in ordinary to Queen Victoria, potentially involved in the so-called Freemasonry plot.
He's a Freemason.
His accomplice, according to the theory, was a coachman called John Netley. I'm sorry. I mean, he played by Ian Holm beautifully, you know.
From Hell.
In From Hell. I'm sorry.
You're not convinced.
I don't think so. When the killings took place, he was in his 70s. He just had a stroke. It's possible, but I don't think it doesn't really
be hard to do that kind of crime with.
Although he had anatomical, he had surgical skills and all of the above.
Did he have a leather apron?
No. James Kelly. Didn't die until 1929. He killed his wife in 1883 by stabbing her in the neck and was sent to Broadmoor.
What, did they just select anyone who'd stabbed women?
I'm only going through the suspects I can manage. He escaped.
Broadmoor?
From Broadmoor. He made a key. He made his own key. After the five canonical murders, he disappeared. And a former New York police detective called Ed Norris claimed that Kelly had gone to the USA, where he committed several more murders. And the profile, that same profile point, matches a Ripper. Kelly went back to Broadmoor in 1927, turned himself in, and died there in 1929.
Took his key and went back.
He gave the key back. I promise you, I'm not making this up. Charles Lechmere, also known as Charles Cross, was a meat cart driver who was the first person to discover the body of Polly Nichols.
I was going to say, is it the same meat carter from earlier?
The first person.
Yeah, the one that was there for maybe 7 to 9 minutes versus 2 minutes.
The double event of Stride and Eddowes was committed when he had a day off. This is not a digression. I was doing yet another serial killer television, and I'm just been filming, and I leave, and the barman says to me, "What have you been doing?" And I say, and he says, "Oh yes, there's a new suspect."
A new Ripper suspect.
Charles Cross. Charles Cross, I'm not saying I know, but there is an awful lot of circumstantial evidence to suggest that the first Ripper killer, Charles Cross, committed the other crimes. But no, before you ask, I do not know why he stopped, and I could be entirely wrong, but there's a great deal of evidence about that first killing which suggests that Cross was there well before either Ronald Paul or the police officer was called, and that he had every possible opportunity. He has a classic, come on, Mo, we've talked about this many times, he's got a classic serial killer background.
Dropped on his head as a baby.
Broken abuse. Home, didn't know his biological father,
killed animals,
bedwetter, two stepfathers, lived on his, and had a job.
With a leather apron.
With a lot of blood on it. It's entirely possible that he killed Martha Tabram, the one of the first two before you get to the canonical five.
Yeah.
And it's also possible that he killed some of the subsequent ones. Now, I'm not in any way saying that I know. I'm simply saying it's at least possible. But look at the people who have been suggested. I mean, Lewis Carroll.
Really?
The author of Alice in Wonderland. He was suggested by two authors because of the anagrams that matched his name. Sickert. Well, Sickert was clearly interested in the Ripper. There's no question of that. But really? Arthur Conan Doyle? Jill the Ripper.
Jill the Ripper?
Yes.
What do you mean?
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle believed that it was a woman.
A woman.
There was the occult group of Freemasons who only went out at night. There was...
The Freemasons are kind of weird, though. And they carry those big briefcases, those funny-shaped briefcases.
I'm not getting into that. and there's... various Poles, Russians. There's Mary Kelly's man, who she lived with until 2 weeks before her death. But the honest truth is that we will probably never, ever know.
We'll never know. That is the truth. We'll never know.
And in a way, I know it's a horrible story.
You're about to say it's better that way.
I think it's better that way.
Do you?
I do.
You honestly think that?
I do. Yeah.
You like the
mystery? I think it's nice that there's a kind of, we don't know. I think it's a whodunit that'll never go away.
Sometimes I say that these murders, the old murders are better. like they're not as bad because they're old. And so they don't feel as, I don't know, when we talk about them, we don't, it doesn't feel as grim as it would when we talk about things that are in the present, or perhaps it's all just mythologized and mystified. And
well, it is, there's a lot of myth in Jack the Ripper. I mean, we don't even know if there was one Ripper. Lots of people say there were three, four, six. I was going to say,
my gut feeling, well, actually, I don't know. I kind of like the idea of two, of not like the idea, but
copycats.
I can imagine two.
You know.
Not, I'm not into copycat, I don't think. I'm not. That's
some of the later ones, you know, do indicate there might have been a bit of a copycat. We don't know for sure.
Maybe.
Anyway, now we should have some questions.
Oh, well, we're going to get Dan to play us out, actually.
Well, we've got some questions.
I've also
first.
Lost Betsy. No, well, Dan's just going to play us out of this, like, we've finished talking about it, and then we're going to raise the house lights and open it to the floor.
Oh, lovely.
Dan, please, would you play us out? Thank you so much. Thank you to my
Thank
brother.
Thank you very much.
We're going to open up to the floor if anyone wants to ask a question. Ideally, it would be about Jack the Ripper, but of course, feel free to ask Jeffrey anything you like. He's a source of knowledge and wisdom, especially on true crime. Yeah, Poppy has a microphone. Oh, I've got one here in the front row.
Did anyone take an interest in the pooling of blood that you first mentioned that only gathered apace slightly later when the first, was it the policeman arrived or the other guy arrived
yeah.
who called the police? That strikes me as being very strange and would indicate another finger pointed at this first guy. Did nobody go into that at all?
He was the cart man.
The answer, honestly, is that at that time, people were so astonished by this awful killing that no one thought to write a timeline. And I think what's significant is that Cross, the meat carrier, Carter, was only too plausible. Let's presume for a moment that he had killed her, Polly Nichols. A man arrives and says, oh, and he immediately says, oh, no, we must call a policeman. I'm not sure it's definitive, but it's very convincing. There are a couple of tiny pieces of evidence that when the constable arrived, there was a big pool of blood. But when the friend, Paul, arrived, there was no blood at all. In other words, the murder had been committed
very recently.
Very, very recently. I'm not saying I know, but I do think it's a very interesting argument. And I think it's interesting too, because if you look at it the other way around, the Mary Kelly's boyfriend, the one at the end, the fifth, he was said to have killed her and killed the others to cover up the fact he was going to kill her at the end. I don't think
that's
that,
elaborate.
I think that's very elaborate. But it, crikey, you know. I'm not sure. I don't think we'll ever know, genuinely. No, it's a pleasure, Tom.
Any more questions? Anyone? Oh, I've got one up here in the check top. I mean, Betsy is filthy.
Oh dear.
I'm surprised that you haven't mentioned one of the suspects, James Maybrick, with the famous diary.
Yes. Well, I'm afraid I didn't mention James Maybrick because I don't believe a word of it. I think he, in the end, distanced himself. I mean, I haven't also named the other Kosminski. I mean, I could go through with you tonight probably another 10 suspects. What I tried to deal with tonight was the ones I believed might have had. You could possibly say maybe around them. I never thought that Maybrick, any more than I thought, for example, another of the Queen's doctors was a possible killer. I think there's so much madness around the Ripper that in the end, almost anyone who had any connection with the Ripper, whether it was a suspect, everyone. I think I remember reading one point that every single person who had any connection with the case was accused of killing. Forgive me, I just think I don't believe it. I don't believe Maybrick. It's very famous, but it's like Druitt or Gull. I just don't believe it. Sorry.
Who do you think did it, Dad?
I don't know.
You definitely don't know.
I confess I don't know.
Anyone else have any other questions?
Betsy didn't do it.
Betsy definitely didn't do it. She was busy getting... I don't actually know what that is that's in your ear hair, but it's sticky, which is a worry. Anyone else have any other questions they'd like to ask? No? Oh, my friend Ness Evans over there, friend and colleague, the steam ed. Poppy's on the move with the mics, which is good news all round.
Did the inspector ever reflect on it later in life? And if so, what were his thoughts?
Abilene reflected on it many times. He had a series of his favourite suspects, one of which was Cohen, but I don't think, despite what it did in From Hell and despite what it, you know, despite the fact he's cast as Sherlock Holmes, I don't think he had any real idea who might have done it. We are in a totally different world. No forensics, no real pathology, no record keeping, no criminal identification, no profiling. I think they genuinely were struggling. And to be fair, and I have insisted on being fair to them all through, the Metropolitan Police Service did their absolute best. They interviewed thousands, detained 80. Every slaughterer, every butcher, everyone had ever worked in anything resembling butchery within the area was interviewed. And not one of them were there. They all had alibis, they weren't there. It wasn't a spectre. Someone actually committed those dreadful crimes. In every way, but my goodness me, I can honestly say tonight, and without a moment's hesitation, I don't know who it was. Daddy. Although I think that Polly Nichols' discoverer has a lot to answer for.
Dad, didn't you just say when we were in the dressing room that those letters were all attributed to news people too?
Yeah, the letters, Dear Boss, Saucy Jackie, and
From Hell.
From Hell may be true. The first two were probably done by journalists stoking up sales for them.
And there were more letters, were there?
There were 100 more.
Yeah. Anyone else? Any more? Harrison Davies there.
We are. Friend, well done.
Esteemed friend, colleague.
Oh, I love it.
Geoffrey, what advice would you give to a young man sort of commencing his journey into Ripperology? If you were just to recommend one book, film or documentary, what would it be as like a starting point? Apart from just listening to this podcast, obviously.
That's very sweet of you. I'd say start with the podcast. But if I were advocating going back to the beginning, enough. I would want anyone to do exactly that. The Whitechapel Murders files are available. You can get them online. The Metropolitan Police now do make them available. What I wouldn't do is go in with a specific conclusion. I think the most interesting thing about the Ripper is that we don't know. It, in a way, what makes it so wonderful. So don't go thinking, oh, I know it was X, or I know. Patricia Cornwell spent, $3 million trying to prove it was Walter Sickert, which she didn't. Walter Sickert almost certainly was in France at the time of the murders. Yes, he had a fascination with murder, and yes, he wanted to stay in the houses that the Ripper stayed in, but he wasn't in the country. Yes, and there was another Sickert who was also involved. And please, I mean, you can spin these theories out of the window, but they don't make any sense. So if I were advising someone who wanted to start again, I'd go right back to the beginning.
There must be loads of forums and stuff, mustn't there?
I'm sure there are.
Yeah. Like people chatting about it as well. Another place to look for info, oops. Great, cool. One last one before home time. Thank you, nice lady here in the red jumper.
Thank you, ma'am.
Hi. This one's more generally about the podcast. So, I mean, just to caveat this, I'm a fan of true crime, and it's booming, so there's obviously an appetite for it. But when I talk to friends about, like, true crime documentaries and podcasts, there are people who kind of see it as kind of indulgent. And how would you respond to, like, any criticism that discussing or deriving entertainment from true crime cases, especially modern ones,
is bad?
Yeah.
Yeah, we talk about that quite a lot, actually, on the podcast, and we try to be as sensitive as possible to the material whilst, well, Geoffrey can attest to this, you wrote about Fred West in the early 90s, and it's really only been in the last however many years that your knowledge about true crime's really taken off. Like, there is just this general interest for it, like, people are fascinated.
But I think it's a very good point. One of the things I think, and we've been talking about it recently, is that we pay too much attention to the perpetrator and we don't pay enough attention to the victims' families. I've been involved in a long series of conversations recently about exactly that point. I'm very keen and will, I hope, be able to make some films about crimes the other way round. I did a part of a book about a young man called Jamie Reynolds who killed a young woman in Shropshire and Telford. Ironically, her father was a police detective who gave the most moving victim's statement to the court. I think my job is to try and, in a way, redress the balance. Yes, of course, I'm going to talk about people who do dreadful things, but I don't do it without thinking very, very carefully about how on earth the victims deal with it. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, and let's not dwell on it tonight because it's a bit gloomy, but you never recover from that kind of thing that happens to your family. And I have an immense feeling for the victims' families. And I wouldn't do what I do if I didn't know that. And I fought for people who have been falsely imprisoned, and I utterly believe. So what I'm trying to do is to tell stories to illuminate what people are capable of. But what I always say at the end of every podcast is that bad things happen to good people. And that's not fair. And I would say to you, do be careful out there. This is not a comfortable world. And that's what I'm trying to explain.
Thanks, Dad. Awesome.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Oh. Before we finish, just want to say thank you to all of you for coming. We appreciate it so much. It means so much to us. And as Jeffrey would say, we started this podcast on the back of an envelope. So it was a labour of love. I want to thank the Whitechapel Society, some of who members are here and who've really supported us. And you can find info out about them. To our wonderful producer, Poppy Damon, who makes everything possible. And basically, we can't do anything without. And Barnaby Spiegel, who is a friend and has helped immeasurably make us sound good and is brilliant. So thank you. And thank you most of all to you, Jeffrey, for hosting this podcast. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, darling. Thank you.